Welcome to the Tinnelly Talks podcast, where we dive into the common legal issues facing today's community associations. Whether you're a manager, board member, or homeowner, you're sure to pick up on some nuggets of advice to help you build a successful community in this ever-evolving and changing world.
Hello and welcome to Tinnelly Talks. I'm Ramona Acosta.
And I'm Steve Tinnelly.
And today we're going to discuss the rising cost of construction with Isaac Camacho of Accurate Termite and Pest Control and Sean Anderson of Association Reserves. Isaac is a managing partner and director of sales and marketing of Accurate Termite and Pest Control. Accurate is the number one provider of pest control services for HOAs in Southern California, serving over 1,500 HOAs. Isaac has served on his own community's board of directors and at various positions in CAI, the Community Associations Institute, across three chapters over his 15 years in the CID industry. Currently, Isaac is the chapter president for the Greater Los Angeles chapter of CAI. Sean started working at Association Reserves in 1999. He opened the regional office in Orange County in 2003. Sean has completed over 3,000 reserve studies for properties ranging from small community associations to large master planned communities. He earned CAI's Reserve Specialist designation and has the distinction of being RS number 68. Sean is an active member of the CAI Orange County chapter. He has been an instructor on the subject of reserves for training courses offered by CAI. Thank you both for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Some of you out there might be asking why we might be talking to a pest control company about construction costs. And Accurate actually does repair work as part of the termite fumigation. You guys do a lot of lumber and not reconstruction, but construction jobs, right?
Quite a lot. So we inspect the communities, find the structural damage caused by wood-destroying organisms like termites, fungus, rot, and then we scope that out. And we do have in-house contractors that can do the repairs.
You know, what we're going to be discussing today really impacts every industry. It's one of the reasons why we wanted to bring in Sean to talk about reserve studies, because it doesn't matter if you're a roofer, a general contractor, a pest control company, an asphalt company, the things that we're going to talk about today really encompass all of our service providers, I think. So just to get us started, let's talk about the elephant in the room, and that is assessments and keeping assessments flat when we know that inflation is going up. And whether inflation, you know, depending on which news channel or which story you read, you know, whether it's 3% or 4%, we know it's going down. We know the inflation percentage is going down, but prices really aren't going down. And why is that, right? It's supply chain shortages. It was hurricanes, tornadoes, wildfires, right? Increases in building materials. Sean, I think you were mentioning in your reserve studies, you're really seeing a lot of these prices that have just gone up and have continued to stay up. So even though the inflation percentage might be coming down, that's not really translating into the cost of our materials and the cost of our construction jobs.
Yeah, that's correct. We're seeing that they increased significantly after 2020. During the lockdown, supply chains were disrupted, and we've had a lot of things like with the minimum wage bill increase going on. That's putting upward pressure on labor costs, so that now supervisors want to make more than the guys who are making more money at the bottom of the labor pool, stuff like that. So we're not seeing the kind of drop off that we thought we might see back in 2021 when things started to normalize a little bit. We're still seeing significant inflation. We've not seen that it's going back down to the historic 3% that we've seen before.
Yeah, and Isaac, I mean, are you guys experiencing that as well, just in terms of, you know, when you're bidding your jobs, your material costs?
Absolutely. One of the things that we tracked closely is lumber, because that's the main material in repairs. In 2019, 1,000 board feet was $350. Since then, it fluctuated a lot. I think people remember how there was a time where lumber was so hot that companies were using it as currency. It stabilized a little bit, but right now it's at $565 per 1,000 board feet. So that's still about 60% higher than what it was in 2019. And there's still a lot of people who expect that we should all be back at 2019 prices, and it's impossible when lumber is 60% higher, and it's not going to go back down to the 2019 rate.
So that's remarkable, right? Because from a reserve standpoint, right, associations are going to do the reserve study every 3 years, right? So let's imagine we had a reserve study done in 2020 or 2019, and we were expecting, hey, we know that we're going to need a new roof, or there's going to be some job that we're going to have to do in terms of, you know, repairing or replacing a major component. There's a lot of lumber that's involved. Fast forward to where we are now, just a few short years later, our reserve study from a few years ago, our last one, right, has got to be, just on the cost of that, 60% off the mark.
Yeah. And if, and remember, the reserve study is giving us three different results. It's telling us our component inventory, our funding plan, and our percent funded. All of those are infected, are affected by inflation. So if we're waiting 3 to 5 years, it's really outdated information. You know, we should really be updating every year because of things like that. You know, if you have a year where we're jumping, you know, we were, I was looking at costs for boilers from 2020 versus now, and the prices shot up astronomically from, you know, I mean, almost about 30-40%. And so if we'd waited those 3 years, 4 years to prepare for that, way below the mark of where we need to be to replace that.
I mean, it's funny you mention that, Steve, because that's a phenomenon that we've noticed in repairs. They're big ticket items, so boards don't move on them quickly, and they tend to sit on them for months. I think our average in at Accurate from bid to close is about 9 months for a repair bid. So 9 months is significant, especially during this time frame where there's been a lot of fluctuation. If you're looking at a bid that is a year old, it's no longer valid, right? So then your vendor is stuck with, well, I got to tell them it, this doesn't apply anymore. Things have changed. Or they don't say anything and they try to see where they can squeeze on either the scope or the quality to try to keep it at the same rate without having to go back and telling them this is not the same scope anymore.
I mean, that's just remarkable. I mean, in your experience, or have you ever seen that aggressive of a delta in terms of where associations are at for one?
No. So, you know, we've been tracking it since 1986, and it's pretty consistent at 3% inflation.
Uh-huh.
And then 2020, it just shot. Way higher. Roofing and asphalt tend to track a little bit higher than other costs, but now across the board costs have just gone up significantly.
Yeah, we've got issues within the insurance market, and that's affecting labor that's marketing. It's just remarkable. You know, a client that, you know, relatively quiet condominium community, their last reserve study, they said, oh, you know, we're feeling good. We're 90% funded. We're going to be able to get that new roof in 2024. Now, all of a sudden, wait a second, we've been following our, you know, what we thought we were supposed to be doing. And now banks are looking at us like we're a massive financial risk. We're woefully underfunded. We thought we needed a $1.5 million roof. Turns out now it's a $4 million roof. I'm sure you have clients going through this stuff. The interesting thing that I see more and more now, Isaac, is, you know, some boards are trying to kind of avoid this. Let's say they've, you know, they're worried about, you know, whether there's, you know, fascia repairs or things like that, or they're worried about having to repaint the project. So what they try to do is they defer this maintenance. They say, well, looking up at the paint looks good from, you know, way down here, but they don't understand what might be hiding underneath that paint, right? And the rot that's going on. So when it comes time to repaint, they're saying, wait a second, we've got to actually replace.
We've got to do some structural repairs. Yeah, and that's what our focus really is structural repairs. Our company doesn't do aesthetics or renovations. It's really just structural repairs. And that's the problem, is that people will go after the aesthetics first, and then that contractor is going to find problems. And then they realize, oh, we neglected our structural, and they get in trouble because they've already committed to an aesthetic repair that is costly because of what we just mentioned, and they don't have enough money to start to go backwards and start from structural and then finish the aesthetics.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because one of the things that we were going to talk about as well, you know, there's inflation costs that are going up. There's also increases in demand, right? It's 2024. If you're a condominium association and you have decks that need to be done, those have to be inspected by 2025, by January 2025. It doesn't mean that the repairs necessarily have to be done, but they have to at least be inspected. And then if you have life safety repairs, then those have to be completed immediately. I would venture to guess that we're going to start seeing some of those prices go up as well, because our contractors are now going to be in demand. If you didn't start this 4 years ago, or at least start reserving for this 4 years ago, you know, you're behind the eight ball at this point, and now there's a limited number of inspectors and there's a limited number of general contractors who can come out to your community and who can take care of these decks.
Yeah, absolutely. We started telling our clients way back in 2020, like, you need to start funding for this. You need to start preparing for it. I remember I did the CAI law seminar and spoke about it, saying, this is coming. Don't wait till the last minute to do it, because it's like anything. If you wait till the last minute, you're going to pay a high premium for that. Those communities that did their deck inspections in 2021 have going to have paid a lot less money than those who are going to do them in 2024 and 2025.
Yeah, not only just because of supply and demand, but just the labor and material costs associated with it, right?
So. Absolutely.
You know, it's interesting in construction in general, all of construction, the labor force tends to have this sort of wave-like in demand of construction jobs. If you look at the data all the way back to the 1990s. So there's this peak, and it usually doesn't go past a certain point per capita of a certain population. And then it dips, and it goes way low. It can drop less than 50% of that labor force for whatever reason, and then it comes back up. So it's sort of cyclical that way. And actually, right now, we're at a peak. So the construction industry is expecting that there's going to be a big dip in the labor force available to do construction jobs, which will inevitably drive costs up again.
Well, that's one of the statistics that I was looking at when I was preparing for the program today. It's the National Association of Home Builders. They've been doing some studies, and they're seeing that the labor force, the workforce for construction, is aging out. And so you have people who are starting to retire, and you have young, able-bodied individuals who don't want to enter the construction industry. Your lifespan in construction is going to be shorter, right? You know, it's a physically demanding job where you might be able to work in an office until, you know, 70, 75. You might not be able to do that on a construction job. We have seen a push more towards college degrees. You're seeing less 20-somethings going into the trades, and more of them are going into professional careers. Not to say that that's a good thing or a bad thing, but just when it comes to construction, right, the labor force just isn't there, and it doesn't look like it's going to be growing anytime soon.
No, it's expected to get worse. And that's what happens, right, is that when there's less of a labor force available, then what companies are going to try to do is to increase wages to be more attractive. Well, those increases have to come from somewhere, right? The companies can only take so much of a hit on their profits before they're going to increase their prices. The cost of labor has increased from 2019 to now about 20% across the U.S. And remember that California is about 38% more expensive in cost of living compared to the U.S. So if you compare the fact that the U.S. has already increased in 20% of the labor force cost in construction, and then add the fact that California is more expensive, you can do the math and see how expensive the labor force is already today and how expensive it's about to get.
This has got to be a pretty remarkable challenge for you in preparing the reserve studies. I mean, what types of conversations are you having now in terms of getting boards to understand what it is and kind of what the circumstance is going to require? I'm assuming now from where you were, you know, 3-4 years ago, the type of assessment increases that you're recommending and the projections and the modeling that you're doing has got to be a lot more aggressive and doomsday than it was before. Could you walk us through that? Because, a variety of different service providers that are in your show, they're having a reserve study, but, I'm always surprised when you get in there and you realize just all the different components that go into it. And I'm assuming you've got to take even a more nuanced approach now.
Yes,
of all these different factors. So give us some insight there.
So we had a statistician from our company do an analysis, and in each point of inflation hits increases your need for reserve funding by 22%. So, yeah, we're having conversations with people that we talked earlier about roofing and stuff like that, that a roof that might have cost $1.5 million a few years ago is now up around $3 million. And we've got to go in, and we kind of look like bad guys, you know, but we couldn't see that coming. There was nobody who was going to see that coming. So we're having to do a lot of, this is where we have to go. But what's happened a lot is we talked earlier also about people's percent funding dropping. People who thought they were 90% funded, but now they're really about 45% funded. What I do tell people is, long term, you'll be better off the better funded you are. So that community that was 90% funded, if they really do drop down to something like 45% funded, at least they're not going down to 5% funded. Mm-hmm. If they were up around 35% funded, and then all of a sudden we've hit this inflation, then they're in a lot of trouble. So we've been doing a lot more board meetings and talking through, hey, everything's more expensive across the board. Gladly, I think right now, a lot of people are starting to see that that we're in an abnormal inflationary environment, that even just going to the grocery store, people are seeing you can't get out of there for under $200.
Yeah, I got four kids. I took them to fast food the other day. You know, I hope my wife isn't listening to this. She wouldn't be a fan. But, I mean, just getting the four kids, you know, cheeseburgers or whatever, I was out of there for like $70.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I feel your pain. I have five. And it's you know, going to McDonald's is not a treat anymore.
We're not doing that. We're going to have some Trader Joe's crackers at home.
Yeah, you know? We're going to enjoy it.
Yeah, we're going to eat some cheese, you know what I mean? Not literally, but I mean, it's just remarkable just how this stuff adds up. And we're seeing some of our clients, and it's kind of a difficult thing because I guess, you know, if I'm a typical homeowner, I don't really understand, you know, we don't want dues, right? We don't want dues to go up, right? And they think dues are, what are they? It's just like this abstract concept. What is that like paying for? That's paying for, I don't know, what is it? Some events that we're having or something like that. But no, the vast majority of it goes to actually what the association has to do and must do and makes sense to do is to maintain the actual building components and assets that are in the community. So we're trying to have these conversations saying, well, we can't raise dues. We have people on fixed income or a membership won't like it. Well, what? For most people, you would expect their unit or their home to be their largest investment, and these dues are going to preserve, protect, ensure that investment. It's just an interesting conversation. I mean, what are you hearing from the boards when you're talking about this, or Isaac, when you're talking about these, you know, the jobs, and you're bidding the jobs, like, wow, why is that so expensive?
Yeah, one of the things that we tell them, aside from the cost of material and labor, how that's gone up, is that you can try to approve those old prices. And there are people who perhaps would be willing to hold old prices. But I think most people are familiar with the term of shrinkflation, which means that some companies, and this is across the board, some companies, in order to keep their customers, are keeping their prices, but they're reducing their offerings, right? And that's happening in our industry too, where we notice it as well, where perhaps you were getting a full structural rehab, meaning you were removing structural components and replacing them with new ones that are going to be good for years to come. Some companies, in order to keep the costs where they used to be, they're not going to remove it and replace it with new lumber, new expensive lumber. They're patching. Mm-hmm. They're using Bondo. They're using epoxies. So that way, they're not going into it for the labor, for the material costs at the prices that are fair for today's market. They're just going in for the labor, and they're able to hold that price. But it's kind of smoke and mirrors. It's shrinkflation. And I think that people need to see that there's no way you can do the same job for prices from 4 years ago. So what is it that is being cut? Is it quality? Is it scope? It has to come out of somewhere. And maybe the board's okay with it. Maybe the board looks at it and goes, you know what, that's fine. But if they don't know, if it's not a conscious decision, that's when it becomes a problem. When later down the road, they're looking at repairs again in 3 years, and they're scratching their head going, wait a second, didn't we just do this? Because they didn't realize the scope changed on them in order to hold a price. So they need to be really conscious about talking to their experts, talking to their vendors, going through the bids, and really comparing apples to apples.
That goes getting to that construction manager, that expert who's actually going to look at those, that scope of work and those specifications to make sure that it's being spec'd properly, right? I think a lot of our boards, they see the construction manager or that professional expert as being one of those costs that can be cut. It's not a necessary cost where your general contractor might be required because you have to replace that deck or you have to replace that roof. But maybe that construction manager is not necessarily a necessary cost. It's something that they can cut. But to your point, you know, that's management is not going to catch something like that. A manager who reads a contract is not going to catch that the scope changed or that it might be more of a Band-Aid than an actual repair. And even if you give the contract to your attorney to review, the attorney might not necessarily catch that either. The attorney's reviewing terms and liability and indemnification.
We're not looking at scope. Right?
Well, it's neither the manager's nor the attorney's job to do that, right? To police each vendor that way, because they wouldn't do that for landscape either, right?
So it's that's my point, is that if that scope got changed out in order to keep the price down, that's something that's not going to be caught unless you hire the right professional to do that.
That's right.
And it's usually that professional is the one that gets cut to save expenses.
That's right. And if they're not using a professional to manage the project, at least someone should be doing regular checks, walking the property. I am still amazed how many times we offer property walks on a project, and we offer them on a set period, depending on the length of the project, right? If it's a long project, every 4 weeks. If it's a short project, every week. And boards just don't. They don't take us up on it. And I mean, it's amazing that they don't, right? That we actually have to fight to get someone to walk it so that we can show them we did what we told you we were going to do. And so if the board's not doing it and a project manager's not doing it, how do you really know what you're getting? Until 3 years later, someone else looks at it, something goes into escrow, or there's a problem. And they go, uh-oh, I don't think we got what we thought we were going to get.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure to subscribe to the Tinnelly Talks podcast at tinnellylaw.com and never miss an episode. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now let's get back to the show.
Have you ever seen a situation where, hey, we re-roofed, 10 years ago. We thought we were getting a 20-year or 30-year roof, but, it was maybe a shrinkflated scope or whatever the deal was. All of a sudden, well, wait a second, guys, actually, we've got to adjust the useful life on this thing.
Sure.
Really?
Yeah. And what ends up happening, and that's talking about updating reserve studies every year and stuff, we want to make sure that we're capturing that. Like, there were times way back in the past where there were vendors that were giving these astronomical lives on stuff like pool plaster and stuff like that. And then you come to find out 8 years later, well, no, it's not going to last that long. So you've always got to kind of keep an eye on that kind of stuff and saying, hey, does this product really last that long? Was it installed properly? That components always, they're like people. They show you gray hairs. They're like, hey, you know what? That pool plaster is not going to last 15 years. It's already chipping at 3 years. So we were always having to keep an eye on that and adjust those lives accordingly each year.
It's crazy to me because, I mean, well-intentioned board members, they get in there, they see what the financial picture is. Oh, our condo, we're paying $500 a month in dues. We can't raise that anymore despite the fact that over the last 3 years, costs have gone. Just the math doesn't pan out. So they're motivated to try to find ways that they could, I mean, it's almost like an assessment increase, right? Or doing it in order to better fund the reserve account. That's just, that's doomsday, right? That is the last option, right? That's the nuclear option. We can't do that. What we're going to try to do is we're going to try to get, make it seem like we're getting what we need to get done within this financial box that we put ourselves in. And every time I've experienced it, in some instances catastrophic, it results in everybody experiencing more pain and paying more money.
Yes.
Then they would have been just doing the job right. And it's, sometimes it's a difficult thing. As lawyers, we're brought in to kind of fix problems, right? We love those clients that, hey, we're going through this. Can you advise us? Because that's really what we look at, counselors. Like, we want your community to be long-term, financially viable. This is the way you go about doing things, right? You utilize experts. You properly fund. If your expert's recommending an assessment increase or a larger reserve contribution, you do those things in order to avoid these scenarios where you're like, oh my gosh, we're totally out of money, or what we thought we paid for is falling through. We've deferred maintenance on our fascia and our wood, and now we're having to do major structural repairs. How did this happen? And it's just because I just don't understand. It's just this motivation or just the optics of not raising dues versus actually doing what you need to do your job.
I wanted to jump on that really quick because so many people run on, I'm not going to raise dues, or we're going to keep dues low.
Yeah.
And then you touched on something that's a big one, is then what they're going to do is defer maintenance. And what we look at is something, if you maintain an asset, it costs 10 times more to replace the asset than to maintain it. If people were just painting their wood regularly and maintaining their wood,
right.
But instead they go, it looks fine. We'll push that off. And then all of a sudden, replacing wood is a heck of a lot more expensive than just having painted it. And so they get these, I call them magic numbers in their head that, $400 is really high dues, but it's not. For the most part, the manager is going to go through it and create the budget. And on the operating side, they're pretty much in line on everything. And on reserves, we're basing our reserve contribution on the deterioration rate of the assets usually. And that's not a magic number. That's how much it's deteriorating. And if we're not funding properly, if we're using magical numbers and saying, oh no, that'll only cost about $150 when it's $15,000, then it's going to be off. And 2 + 2 always equals 4. So they end up having to pay for it anyways out of special assessments.
That's actually what I was going to ask, because we have the benefit here is, you know, we do general counsel and we do collections, right? So we get to see this from both sides of the table. From a management standpoint, I would much rather see a board raise their assessments every year to keep up with the cost of living, do a 3%, 5% increase every single year to keep up with the cost of living. The homeowners will come to expect that. They will come to budget for that versus keeping your assessments artificially low and keeping them stagnant with the intention of when that roof comes up, when that wood comes up, then we'll just special assess for it. Because, you know, we're starting to see special assessments of $30,000, right? Yeah, if the homeowner couldn't pay a $500 regular assessment, how are they going to pay a $30,000 special assessment?
Well, it's crazy because, I know, one scenario I heard about, they were fully funded. They had what they needed. Let's just say they needed a million dollar roof project, right? They had the money in 2019, had the bid, were ready to go. The board, for whatever reason, tried to push it off, and COVID hits, and now they're in a situation where it's a $3.5 million roof, and they're assessing their membership, each unit,
yes,
you know, north of $20,000, just because at the time, well, that's a big project. We don't want to go through it, rather than just saying it's reached the end of its useful life. Well, nothing bad's happened right now. What are we going to do? And try to advise our clients, you know, and try to give ammunition to the managers. Be like, listen, board member, if you want to do that with your personal assets and your personal money and take that gamble, that's one thing. But when you're spending everybody else's money, right, making decisions that are affecting their security, right, you gotta look at it with a different perspective. And it's just remarkable. I mean, yeah, from the Alterra, from the collection side, I mean, the majority of the files, typically homeowners delinquent regular assessments. Now it's seems like half the files that we're opening up is special assessments that the association had to levy just because it was underfunded, and, you know, cost of insurance premiums, cost of projects are going up, and that's what we're seeing.
And how are you advising association like the one that you just mentioned has a $20,000 special assessment. Generally, that would have to go to the membership for mm-hmm. approval, right? It exceeds that 5%. I'm assuming it's going to exceed that 5%. For their regular assessment budget. I know, you know, from the business development side, I get questions. You know, we have an association, they need a special assessment. They want to know if it qualifies as an emergency special assessment. Is it a life or safety issue, or is it an unforeseen expense? How do you go about advising them? Because sometimes, was it really unforeseen? Maybe they didn't know, but maybe they should have known. I mean, how are we approaching those types of situations?
Yeah, it's it's a gray area, right? This is, use another cliche, it depends. We typically view matters involving life safety as emergency matters.
Right.
But as lawyers, you mean you don't get a law degree, you don't pass the bar because you're an expert on what constitutes life safety in a residential context, right? There's somebody else, right, that is an expert in that regard, whether it's a structural engineer, civil engineer, something to that effect. So we tell our clients, you need to get a recommendation from an expert who's qualified, right? If an expert who's qualified comes to you, provides that recommendation, associate, you know, fixes their name to it saying, yes, this is absolutely a life safety condition, you as a board have satisfied your due diligence. And on the basis of that, we can authorize or at least advise them to levy a special assessment. But without that, if they're just saying, oh, we don't have the money, or, you know, or we didn't know that this thing was coming up, even though that we knew it was coming up, and we don't have the money, therefore it's an emergency. You know, I think people would play fast and loose with that, especially now with the growing industry of plaintiff's lawyers.
Well, I think I may have a real life example. When I was board president of a condo community in San Clemente of about 290 condos, big community, 3 pools, water features all throughout the community, so it was expensive. And I was the first one to introduce assessment raises in years, so I wasn't very popular. I believe sometimes the life safety may be too low of a bar, because when I was looking at our finances, I saw that we were spending anywhere from $14,000 to $18,000 a month on leak repairs. So the plumbing was just bad, right?
Yeah.
When you're spending that much money a month.
Like, was it really unforeseen?
No one's life was in danger, but we're spending $14,000 to $18,000 a month on leak repairs. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, no one's going to die from it or even get sick probably. But does that actually make sense to be that reactive, right? To defer that much maintenance? And some people understood, but you can imagine how that went down in the HOA, where it had been years since there were any assessment raises. And I introduced that concept because of the education that I'd gotten from experts like Sean, experts like Steve, and other experts in CAI. It actually passed, but it wasn't painless. It was not painless. So I understand when I'm talking to a board member who's like, this is not fun. Yeah, I get it. I actually did it. I understand. But you know what? When after we got the plumbing issue under control, which took a couple of years to actually get it under control, it was so much better. Then we had money. Now the community has solar panels because they have expendable cash years later, right? Now they have things that they couldn't think about before. The water features actually work and they're pretty now.
Yeah.
Because the money isn't being drained and being reactive to bad plumbing.
Yeah. I think it's kind of this weird, I don't know if misnomer is the right expression, but some people say, oh, we don't want to raise assessments because that hurts property values. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to defer maintenance and cut down on stuff. Like, we're going to have these assets and amenities. They're not going to function as intended, as though
that doesn't also affect property values
from the outside. Right. So it's just like, oh, my gosh, someone's going to look at your community's beautiful. It's well run. It's well funded. Right. People are savvy enough. Certainly lenders are savvy enough, right, to understand, okay, well, this is why assessments are that level. But just because a community, right, that's across the street is $100 less, that doesn't look nearly as good. Everything's broken. When you look in their budget, look in their reserves, they have no money, as though that property somehow is going to be more expensive or more highly valued simply because its assessments are $100 less a month, right? It just doesn't make sense.
Sean, how often are you invited to a board meeting to talk to the board about your reserve study?
We're invited probably about 20% of the time. And usually it's to discuss bad news. You mm-hmm. know, my communities that are 100% funded, it's usually like, hey, thanks. You know, we'll talk to you later.
Yeah.
It's when they're 20% funded and we're recommending a $20,000 unit special assessment that, mm-hmm. that we're invited in to talk. You know, we just talk them through. Here are the numbers. Here's how much your roof is going to cost. And unfortunately, it's usually, and I do always have to share this with them, that it's usually a decision that was made 25 years ago. It was, we want to keep dues low for 25 years. And then it's a pain in the neck to get assessments to go up because there's been a culture made of we keep dues low artificially. Whereas if there was a culture built up, hey, we're just increasing dues 3% a year, usually they're very well funded. And so, yeah, we usually have to talk them through that kind of thing.
That's an expectation.
I think it's something that managers don't take enough advantage of. At least, you know, back when I was managing, reserve analysts did not charge to go to meetings. I don't know how it is now. When I present a budget to the board and I'm recommending an increase in assessments, and, you know, most of that is going to go towards the reserves, you know, I was joking a little bit earlier, you know, that's where negotiations begin. And that's where, you know, I'm doing my best to get the board to even give me $5 when I really need 20%. I think that is a missed opportunity to bring the reserve analyst in to really sit down and talk to the board and say, look, this is where the money is going. These are, you know, we did the site inspection. This is the stuff. These are the items that we see that are coming up that are going to need to be replaced in the next 3 to 5 years. This is where the shortfall is. This is what's happening inflationary wise, right? And really have that down and dirty conversation with board members that managers know but may not have enough financial expertise to really have that conversation. And I think it's a missed opportunity for you to be able to come in and talk to the board about that and really give them a good picture of what's going on with the reserves. It's not just a savings account. There actually is a purpose for those funds.
Yeah, in fact, we don't want them to think of it as a savings account because they're not going to save it. Money's always going to be coming in and coming out.
Right.
And to your point, I think a well-educated board is a good board. And so what I do tell most managers, well, I also want to educate managers. I want managers to be able to go in and confidently say, this is why the reserve analyst is recommending this. And if they're still getting pushback, have them call the reserve analyst. Why are you recommending? Because as you just pointed out, the budget, the reserve contribution is usually about 15 to 40% of the assessment. And so it drives so much of it. And mm-hmm. so you need to understand, the treasurer needs to understand why he's recommending that. And so, yeah, we do. We love talking to board members and saying, hey, this is why we're recommending what we recommend.
I think one of the best things an educated manager can help with is sometimes boards lose sight of what the purpose of an HOA is. An HOA is a corporation. And they get caught up in the politics of it. I want to keep my neighbors happy. I mean, I get it. I've been there. It's challenging to live in the HOA that you're on the board of because you have to face the residents, your neighbors all have an opinion of, over your decisions. But it is a corporation, right? It's not just a political position. So if you're underfunded in a company, what do you do? Right? Would you really just try to keep your employees happy and keep hemorrhaging money until you go bankrupt? You wouldn't do that in a corporation,
right?
So why do we think of it that way in an HOA? And I think managers can help by reminding board members, your board of directors in a corporation. Your corporation is financially trending down. You know, make a decision as a corporate director, not as a neighbor. And I know that's tough. I know that's really tough. I've been there, but that's the way we got to be thinking.
Yeah, you have a duty to the community to do what's best for the community.
I mean, that's just it. I mean, I think it's a lot of times too. From Ramona, what you said, I'm imagining this, you know, hypothetical scenario where you're sitting there and you're trying to negotiate with a board, trying to get the board to do what it's legally obligated to do. Right? The code doesn't say you shall make decisions that your neighbor likes. It says you shall what for reserves? Exercise prudent fiscal management and maintain the reserve account for assessments. You shall levy assessments sufficient to perform your obligations. So the managers go out there. Maybe some traction could be had there if we start presenting to the board where, well, this is a recommendation and this is probably a good idea toward, no, this is legally what you guys have. You have to raise assessments. This is what your assessment requirement is. This is what your experts that have come in to advise you as volunteers are telling you. This is what you need to perform your obligations. And the code says you shall assess in an amount needed to perform your obligations. For you doing it, right, you're actually violating the code. I feel like if we kind of take sometimes more of a strict stance and really black and white, give the board an understanding of, just kind of like with the balcony bill. Oh, we have to have our balcony inspected? Yes, it's a law.
Yeah.
Oh, we have to increase assessments? Yes, it's actually a law. You have to assess in an amount that you need to actually maintain this project, to maintain the financial solvency of the corporation. And if you don't do that, that's where the cases of breach of duty come from. Well, you know, set aside all the issues of special assessments. We've got clients that had to special assess their membership in circumstances. And imagine you're a new homeowner, you've been in the community 6 months, and boom, you're getting hit with a $15,000 special assessment, right? Oh, finally we got to afford a condo in the, you know, ever increasing home prices in California. And then boom, right away, I mean, we haven't even paid off the, you know, cost of moving and all that other stuff, $15,000 special assessment, because decisions made by prior boards to try to sweep this stuff under the rug finally caught up to us.
Well, and that's a good point, too, because there really are no consequences, right? I mean, there are consequences in terms of you're going to have deferred maintenance, and at some point there's going to be a special assessment, right? And these are all kinds of, these are all can down the road type of consequences. Today's board that made the decision is probably not going to be the board that's going to suffer the consequences. It's going to be the one 15, 20 years down the road. But we're starting to see governmental type of consequences, right? SB 326 was a reaction because you had, and it was an apartment complex, but you had a landlord that didn't maintain a balcony and people died. Now you're seeing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that are not giving loans on associations with deferred maintenance because of Champlain Towers in Surfside, because there was deferred maintenance, right? So you're starting to see state legislatures and federal regulatory agencies that are starting to say, look, Association Board of Directors, if you're not going to do your job, then we're going to do your job for you. And now you're going to have to pay for it. And there will be assessment increases because now you have to do it, and you have to do it right now because there's a deadline on SB 326, or there's a homeowner who wants to sell their home and can't. Mm-hmm. And I'm not seeing an appetite from the legislature, at least here in California, to reverse that anytime soon. In fact, they're becoming more regulatory.
Yeah, there's more. They're forcing the hand. And honestly, I remember when I think you and I, Ramona, we were preparing for SB 326 and preparing our, you know, program on it and all these things, and we're reading the bill, kind of looked at each other, we're like, well, you know, everybody's, you know, kind of complaining about this, and we can understand it's going to be painful, but this is probably a pretty good idea. because we see all the scenarios. I mean, we were seeing condominium associations that didn't want to do any balcony maintenance, so they were asking us to amend their CC&Rs to put the responsibility for structural repair of a third-story balcony onto a homeowner, whatever the contractor, the homeowner wanted to do. They just didn't want to think logically about how that can, you know, ultimately come to hurt. So we, you know, we like the bill. Obviously, there's some aspects of the legislation that come out that are seeming a little wonky, but in a lot of areas, I think they're getting it right, that we have a lot of homeowner board members that, you know, might be well-intentioned, but are, you know, looking at their standpoint of our job is to keep dues low, rather than actually make sure that, you know, these assets are being maintained. And when it comes to a life safety standpoint, that should be paramount.
I, too, was worried about that bill when it passed, as I'm always nervous when the government's going to step in and say, do something, do this, do that. But one of the reasons I think it's been a good thing is how many bad balconies have been exposed with these inspections.
Really? What are you seeing?
Well, I'm going to defer that to Isaac. But, yeah, we're seeing – I mean, think about it. We're seeing – we talked earlier about special assessments. How many of these communities are opening up their decks and going, oh my gosh, you know, now we have to do X amount of repairs on these balconies. We've got to special assess for it because we couldn't have prepared for it. Without this bill, we would have never known that. People would be standing up on those balconies that now we got $20,000 unit special assessments because they're so structurally unsound.
The most extreme example I know of is we got called in to help with a community, I think it's La Habra. It's either La Habra or La Mirada. The HOA was literally red tagged.
Today's episode is brought to you by Altera Assessment Recovery. Altera provides comprehensive attorney-supervised assessment collection services to community associations throughout California. Trust us with your collection needs. We'll get the job done, done right, and as quickly and efficiently as possible. Altera Assessment Recovery, we're the collection team you've been looking for.
Where the city came in because finally the board of directors had to have someone look at the balconies, right? Whoever this was alerted the city. They came in and they said, oh my gosh, I'm scared of what is going to happen here. So he immediately alerted the city. And the city got involved right away. It turns out they were doing minimal patchwork, minimal paintwork throughout the years. And it really was that bad. It was even before Champlain. This is how bad this community is. Mm. The structural damage was just rampant. It had been decades since anyone looked at the structural components. They kept just doing Band-Aids, Band-Aids, Band-Aids so that they could keep their dues low. That's the most extreme example. I don't expect that that's going to be the majority, especially when contractors who are involved and who are educated in the industry, contractors that you look for in CAI, yeah, tend to be pretty well-versed. Your managers who continue to get education, you're not likely to see those scenarios, but it's still out there. And how many other communities haven't been looked at that well?
Yeah, you're not going to see the red tagging. When I walk into management companies, I give my story. You know, one of the things I always mention is that, you know, I was the condo queen. And at one point, you know, I had all condominiums. My entire portfolio was 10 condominiums, all deferred maintenance, all about 20-30% funded in reserves. Those were my babies. I became an expert in those. And to find a soft deck was not uncommon. You'd be walking around to go visit something and you'd take a step on, it could be a deck, it could be a stairwell, but you'd be like, uh-oh, you know, I need to have somebody come out here and take a look at that. And a soft deck doesn't happen overnight. It takes years to develop.
Yeah, and it's years of deterioration. And unfortunately, nobody was really looking at that until the balcony bill,
uh-huh,
right? And so, like, we've recently adjusted National Reserve City Standards to incorporate stuff like structural inspections, that you can include that in the reserve study because it's so important, because of Champlain Tower South. You know,
these predictable life cycle, right? All
right.
Those components.
Well, that's it. Like with our balcony bill, we know it needs to get done every 9 years. Mm-hmm. Now we have a good idea of what it's going to cost. We've got a life cycle there. We've got to include it in the reserve study and prepare for it every 9 years.
The reserve studies, you know, and Steve mentioned this earlier, the reserve study is required to be completed every 3 years with an on-site inspection. When you and I were talking earlier in preparing for the podcast today, we were talking about, you know, really there's a need to update that reserve study annually, at least do the financial update in the in-between years, So you can catch the inflation, so you can catch the costs of material, so that you can catch the changes to the legislation and all of those things that may not have been effective 3 years ago when you did your last study.
Yes. You know, there's tons of benefits of updating your reserve state every year because you're using actual live numbers each year. In California, you have to do your disclosure form every year too. So if you don't do a reserve study, you don't have a disclosure form, so you're out of civil code for not doing that. But most importantly, it's just good planning because of what we just talked about. With the amount of inflation we've been seeing, if you're still planning on the plan that we had 3 years ago, you're planning to fail.
Yeah.
Right. Because the plans like has woefully, to be totally different.
Like, I mean, it's just so far off the mark.
Yeah. You cannot have a 3 year number in your mind. You need to be doing a reserve study annually.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Not in this climate.
Yeah.
Not with, how aggressive things are rising. Right?
Yeah.
If you're, listen to this. Oh, my community had their reserve study 3 years ago. You are underfunded. I can guarantee you that.
Yes.
I mean,
things have changed.
Already at least 20%.
Yeah, already at least underfunded. On the reserve thing, where you're talking about reserving for, expert inspections and things like that, like actually building those in. You know, there's been bills that have been passed that are going to affect multifamily environments in ways that we don't really know yet. The legislature has done a couple things where they passed a law that says, hey, in a few years, something's going to happen, right? That's, balcony bill was, hey, a few years, this is due.
Now we've got the EVs.
Charging. We got to have EV charging stations in multifamily developments. And, if you're a condo project built in the 80s and the 90s, do you have the electrical infrastructure to sustain whatever regulations the legislature is going to come up with? Is that something that associations
And the potable water to recycled water.
Yeah, the reclaimed water, that type of conversion. I mean, those types of things. Is there a way, should an association start talking to the reserve analysts about that type of stuff?
Certainly talk to them. So it's going to have to be done on a case-by-case. You mentioned for the EVs, if you're adding new, EV chargers, generally that's going to be a capital improvement because remember the reserve funds are there for the deterioration of the assets that are already there. Mm-hmm. So if we take that and install new EV charging stations, then we're taking that money away from the roof. Mm-hmm. And we're already playing from behind on the roof.
But the retrofitting of the existing electrical lines.
There you go. Yeah. So that's the way you want to look at it. You want to look at if we're retrofitting and changing the existing system, we do want to start preparing for that. We want to, and I think in particular with the conversion to everything being electrical, that's going to be another big shoe to drop. And I honestly don't know how that's going to play out because, as you pointed out, so many buildings were built 40 years ago. They can't do it. They can't without ripping everything out and installing.
Yeah, trenching. We got the whole thing. Panel upgrades everywhere. I mean, it's going to be monumentally expensive.
Yeah, I don't know.
And if we're forced to do it, you guys need to pull a permit for some common area work that you're doing, and as a condition of the permit, you have to put in a bank of charging stations.
And I'm thinking the same thing in terms of the recycled water, right? I mean, if we have to. I don't know that we're going to have to dig up lines or anything like that, but if we're going to have to change out vaults and meters and things, they need to be able to reserve for that.
Yeah.
And we don't. And again, it's one of those things that we don't know what it's going to entail, but we know that it's going to be coming down in the next 3 to 5 years. So why not start putting some money aside for it?
Well, that's it. Or just make sure you're in the best funding position you are right now.
Yeah.
So those communities that are 30% of our clients that are 70 to 100% funded are going to weather that storm way better than those that are 30% funded.
Totally.
The best plan is to prepare for that and get as well funded as you can. And as those variables become more clear and you could say, we're going to have to do this project and it's going to cost X amount, like we talked about with the balcony bill. In 2020, I was telling people, get ready for this. Get ready for this bill.
Yeah.
It's coming. And those communities that said, yep, let's start doing it. Let's do the balcony. Let's do our inspections early. Let's start planning for the repairs. And those ones that are about 30 or 70 to 100% funded, they weathered that storm really well. There's a lot of communities now that as they dig into their balconies, they're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Got it. So we need to be with this climate and with the uncertain regulatory future that's there and the cost of we need to be like in financial prepper mode.
Yes.
We need to be stashing some money under the proverbial mattress, so to speak.
Well, and I kind of wanted to put a bow on just the legal obligation just in terms of funding reserves, because I've heard this many times, and I love the way that you say it, Steve, is that the board has a duty to assess at a level that is required to maintain their assets. Because what I hear more often than not is the legislature, the civil code says that you have to perform a reserve study, but it doesn't say that you actually have to fund reserves. I'm going to say it. I think that's kind of a cop-out. I think that, if a board is fulfilling its duties and if it's really interested in maintaining its assets and really considering that sense of community and how this impacts the members, they really do need to be funding at an appropriate level. They shouldn't just take that reserve study and do it and then put it in the file drawer and never really look at it again.
Well, I remember looking at the code originally when it said the board shall exercise prudent fiscal. What does that mean? What percent funded do we need to be? I think it's tough to kind of legislate that, right, based upon all the variables that go into it. But I mean, I'm sure you get that question all the time. What level do we need to be to be considered healthy? And it's an impossible thing to answer. It varies based upon what the community is there for, right? A high rise needs to be funded at a different level than a planned development with just a park, right? It's a totally different story. But how has that changed your typical answer to that or the resulting answer just in the last few years?
So we do have a measure for that. Ultimately what percent funded does is it measures special assessment risk. So associations that are poorly funded, that really means they've got a very high risk of special assessment and deferred maintenance. There's some thresholds we have. So being below 30% funded, you've got starting at a 37% chance of special assessment. The lower you get in percent funded, you've got a 50% chance of special assessment. It's almost magical how you just get up to 31% funded, and all of a sudden, you've really only got a 10 to 15% chance of special assessment. So that's a big number. We don't want to be below 30% funded. Mm-hmm. And then once we get above 70% funded, we've only got about a 1% chance of special assessment. And then 100%. And interestingly, being 100% funded, you've got a 0.1% chance of special assessment, something like that. So even just getting above 70% funded, you're going to be way better off and prepared for
the future. So you like that 70 number?
I always tell people, so when you look at your reserve study and you, if you're one of my little engines that are very poorly funded, get above 30%, work hard, get above 70%, and I'm over 30 years. And that's the other thing is, as long as you're making steady contributions and building strength, if I can get you to 100% funded in year 30, that's wonderful. In the short term, I want you above 30% funded because I don't want you to have high special assessment risk.
And you know what I've noticed, Sean, is that in reserve studies themselves, there is a difference in quality. They're not all created equal. I've seen reserve studies that include, for example, items like fumigation for a condo complex. If you're in California, you're going to need to tent that building at some point, right? Typically once every 20 years. But if you don't have reserves for it, when that comes up, it's a big project and people start to go, uh-oh, where do I find the money?
Yes.
And if you have a complete reserve study, because you can game the numbers. If you just exclude fumigation, if you exclude structural repairs, then you look like you've got a bigger percentage, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. So I've noticed that you really have to understand how thorough your reserve study is going to be. And you don't want to get in a position where you're asking for the reservist to lie to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you put bad data in, you're going to get bad data out. And so to your point, I had a termite guy tell me one time, there are two kinds of buildings in California, those that have termites and those that are going to have termites, right? So if you're just ignoring that, you're going to put yourself in a really bad position. Always include every component that complies with National Reserve City Standards, and termite fumigation is one of them. And make sure that you're funding for everything that fills that and is a common area asset. That's the number one test, is it's a common area asset. Tell the truth. This is the status of the fund. This is how we're going to get there. You're 20% funded. Here's our plan. And you can't lie to yourself and assume, well, if I close my eyes and I really wish hard, then I won't have this special assessment, because you're going to get termites. You've got to figure out how to do that. Whether you do it aggressively through operating funds and have an annual, allotment each year whatever you're going to do, or if you're going to really fund for it through reserves, do it and have the actual plan in the reserve study.
It's so much better to be prepared and not need it, which I've seen some communities, they have reserved for it and it comes up and they tell us it's that time. And we tell them, actually, you're golden. You've done your inspections every year. it's pretty good. You don't need to fumigate, just a couple of local treatments, you should be fine. And so then they have this little honeypot that they can do something else with, as opposed to the communities that have to special assess and then tell people that they got to move out for a fumigation. It's just no good.
Yeah, nightmare scenario. Yeah.
And how are you, it's not all associations, but how are you handling those few associations or those few boards that want you to fluff the numbers a little bit? Can you add, you know, a few years here? Can you take this reserve item out? Because there are those boards, it's not a lot of them, but there are boards out there that they see the numbers that you're presenting to them and they start, you know, they start wanting to play around with them a little bit and massage them a little bit.
Number one is I can't sign my name to a document that I don't believe in. So every one of our reserve cities, whoever the project manager is, our seal with our RS is stamped on it. If you know, Isaac tells me it's going to cost, you know, to rebuild the decks at $100,000. And they say, well, no, we actually think it's going to be $50,000. Okay, I'm sorry, but the reserve still said he's going to say it's $100,000 because he's the expert. You know, you're a board member. He's the expert. And so we also absolutely rely on our fellow experts in the industry, too. As soon as we begin an engagement, we call all the vendors of the association and say, what's it going to cost to replaster the pool? What's it going to cost to do fumigation at that community? And that way we're building on real numbers. Individual components could vary. So if a board member says, Sean, that pool heater looks great. We think we can get another year out of it. Sure, no problem. I don't care about that because nobody's life and safety is going to be involved with that. But if they tell me that the elevator that barely moves is going to have 10 more years of life, I'm going to laugh at them and say, I'm sorry, I'm not changing my reserve study. So, yeah, we just have to tell the truth on things.
So much respect for that, right? And if anybody who's sincere about wanting to do a good job and promote this industry and raise the standards of this industry, get surprised people, they feel compelled to tell, you know, these boards what they want to hear when the job is to tell them what they need to hear.
Yeah.
Right? And that's it. And a lot of times, you know, that's what develops the best client relationship and the best, I mean, I've had, you know, clients look at me and say, well, you better change your opinion, otherwise we're going to find a new attorney. I said, just tell me where you want me to send your files.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, or, you know, you work too hard for this reputation. And understanding that, right, if you're engaged by, you know, the client, who's the client? It's the corporation.
Right.
It's not the board members or whatever, you know, personal interest they have in the matter, right? It's the corporation. So respecting that. And it's the same thing for the managers that are listening, right? When you're sitting there, you don't need to be afraid to propose a budget increase. If anything, you should stand proudly. The corporation, my client, right, my principal needs this money. Legally, you as a board should be assessing in this amount in order to perform your obligations on behalf of really our shared master, right, which is this corporate entity, right? And I think we take that approach. Might be an easier sell, as those, I don't want to use that term, you have to sell the board to do their legal job, but sometimes that's what you really need to do, right? You need to look at them and say, listen, I understand your concern, and as much as I want to tell you what you want to hear, you're not my client, right? Your corporation's my client, right? And my contractual, my ethical, my professional responsibility to the corporation, my client, is to make this recommendation, and I'm not changing it. Even though you might want to try to find somebody else who's going to play ball with you, we don't operate that way, and I know you gentlemen don't, you know, with your lines of work as well. And managers that are out there, especially new, I know you feel that pressure. These board members, oh, you better find a solution to this, you better do that. And a lot of times I see, you know, managers that do the best, that have to generate the most respect from their clients, are the ones that stiffen their back and say, no, this is how it's going to be, and this is the recommendation, and I'm not changing my recommendation.
It's a shift in perspective, and I think a lot of the pushback that we get from those particular boards, it usually boils down to, you know, playing politics in the association, wanting to get reelected, worrying about the fixed incomes of the members. And really, you know, if you look at it big picture and you look at the members as your shareholders, what are we doing, right? We're preserving their property values. We're making it easier for them to pay a regular assessment than to have to pay this monumental special assessment, right? We're supposed to be doing what's best for the membership as a whole, for the community as a whole. And I think if we look at it in that perspective, it shifts the way you would look at it. A $500 regular assessment might feel like a big number, but when you actually sit there and you dial it back and you look at all of your financial statements and your reserve study and the condition of the community, it might actually not be enough. Maybe it needs to be $600, and that's going to be easier for the homeowner to pay that $100 increase than it's going to be for them to pay that $30 special assessment down the road. That's going to be much more painful for them to have to figure out how to come up with that.
Well, I love what Steve said, that the client is the corporation. I'm going to borrow that.
Yeah, that's true.
Because you're right. You're right. The client is the corporation.
Yeah, you're not signing a contract. It's signed by a board member on behalf of the corporation. But Joe, the board member, isn't your client. Right? Yeah. You're contracting with the corporation. That's who your contractual obligation and your contractual duty to. Even if Joe says, hey, we don't want to do that, can you bondo this thing up for us? No, we don't work that way.
Yeah, that's right. And don't you, Ramona, have an analogy that I like? Don't you use the analogy that the manager is the COO of the corporation?
Yeah, the manager is the CEO of the corporation, right? And the board sets policy, and the manager carries it out. You know, the board sets the what, and the manager sets the how. And the manager is the one who has the alphabet soup behind their name. They're the one that's talking to the homeowners every day. They're the ones who are out, you know, doing the site inspections with the contractors. So, you know, if the manager is telling you, hey, I spoke with the reserve analyst, and the reserve analyst said, you know, that's the expert advice that they're getting. And to your point, Steve, you know, that's managers do have to straighten their back sometimes and say, no, this is, you know, boards, you have a fiduciary duty to the corporation, but I'm the manager and I also have a fiduciary duty to the corporation. I also have to do what's best for the membership. And if I do have the alphabet soup, I also have a code of ethics that I have to abide by. And that means that I have to give you my best advice. And you might not like that advice, and I appreciate that. And you're the board, and it's your right to make the decision that you believe, you know, that you should make. But I have to give you my best recommendation. That's my job.
All right, so kind of bringing this home here, so what are you, Isaac, predicting conservatively in terms of how you're bidding your jobs, what the, you know, from where we are right now, 2024, where we're going to be next year? I mean, stuff's still going to be going up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. For the reasons that I mentioned, we expect a labor shortage in the coming years. The cost of lumber is not going down at all, and if anything, will go up. If there's a labor shortage, then it will artificially drive lumber up until lumber starts to sell again. So absolutely, there will be more increases in the construction industry.
Yeah, and I'm reading too that insurance costs are going to continue to rise as well. And I'm not talking about the commercial insurance for the condominium associations. I'm talking about your insurance as a contractor, because the more unskilled laborers you have on your job sites,
right,
the more workers' comp claims, the more liability claims.
Yeah. And so those are going into the job.
Yeah.
And then the result of that, right, is your standard, you know, reserve.
Oh, yeah. My project managers and I are building in 10% increases to start. No, that each year, at least I think for the next 3 years, we are telling our clients actively, hey, this is not going to slow down.
You know, as our industry is getting a little bit more sophisticated, right, we're seeing, you know, professionals such as yourselves that are in there. And for the managers, because, you know, in our industry, you get, you know, managers that come in, they're young, you get associations that you have to start managing. You might have come from an apartment background or a hospitality background, a customer service background. This stuff can seem intimidating, but, you know, one of the reasons why we love doing this is just to be able to showcase experts, professionals such as yourselves, and really encourage managers to utilize you as assets. I mean, you know, when you need to explain these things to boards, when you need to understand, you might have to have these difficult conversations. You don't have to have them alone, right? To talk about insurance premium increases, they're insurance agents, right? You've got reserve analysts, you've got your professional contractors and your fumigation experts, you have legal counsel that's there to assist you. Don't be hesitant to kind of leverage, right, that collective knowledge.
Don't be afraid to invite your experts to meetings. And I know a lot of managers, and I speak from experience, you don't want your two-hour meeting to turn into a three-hour meeting. I totally get it. But, you know, the experts are here. We call them business partners for a reason, right? It's a partnership. Don't be afraid to utilize them. Have them come to the meeting. Have them really sit down, talk to the board, explain the situation.
Well, yeah, you guys mentioned earlier about for projects, having a project manager manage the projects. A manager needs to be a manager. She or he needs to rely on experts like us to help them do their job as manager. But let me be the reserve analyst. Let Isaac do the termites and the construction, and let us share our expertise and make your job as manager easier.
Absolutely. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you all for listening. We'd also like to thank Isaac Camacho and Sean Anderson for your time and expertise. Make sure to visit our website at tinleylaw.com if you haven't already, where we break down this episode, and stay tuned for our next one.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
To share or subscribe to the Tinley Talks podcast, visit us at tinleylaw.com. There you can find links to everything discussed in this episode, locate helpful resources, check out other episodes, and submit questions for future topics. And be sure to tune in next month for our next episode. As always, the views and opinions expressed by the podcast, its presenters and guests do not constitute legal advice. For more information on the topics discussed in today's podcast, please consult with your association's legal counsel. This is Tinnelly Talks, presented by Tinnelly Law Group, your community, your counsel.